You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, world, and welcome to Tales from Hollywood Land, a veritable feast of movies, television, Broadway, showbiz stories, news and gossip, with Julian Schlossberg, Arthur E. Friedman, and Stephen J. Rubin. Today, we're talking classic sci-fi in Hollywood before 1970. And now, here's Julian, Arthur, and Steve.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good, Steve. How are you this week?
I'm particularly excited about this episode because this speaks to my ute. On many levels. But I'm going to defer to Julian because I know Julian told us last week after we finished that one of the scariest movie experiences he's ever had was seeing a particular film. And Julian, I'll let you introduce it.
1951, I'm about 9 years old, and a group of kids go to see The Thing. Now, The Thing is now known as The Thing from Another World, but I can guarantee you, and I think Arthur would back me up, it was only called The Thing. I don't know where this From Another World thing came from, but at that time, it was The Thing. This is a really interesting story. The guy who wrote it was Charles Lederer. Now, Charles Lederer himself had an incredible history. Charles Lederer's parents divorced when he was a young boy, and he ended up living with his sister in Los Angeles. Her name? Marion Davies. That's right.
Ooh.
Okay, number one. Now, number two, Lederer ends up writing a lot with Ben Hecht, and they write things like His Girl Friday and Comrade X, and they... Ben Hecht and Lederer go to Howard Hawks, a great producer-director, and say, listen, we just read a great short story, and we want you to buy it. It's called Who Goes There? So he spends an enormous amount of money, $1,250, and he buys this short story, and that becomes The Thing. Lederer is the sole screen credit, but Ben Hecht and Hawks supposedly wrote a lot of it. This is a strange time, guys, because the Soviets have exploded the atomic bomb in 1949. The paranoid country of the United States is really frightened of the possibility of them using that atomic bomb. And these science fiction films, supposedly, have grown out of that kind of fear that was going on. In fact, in 1955, the Soviets then exploded the hydrogen bomb after we had done it earlier. So it was a pretty frightening time. Anyhow, the thing is, we all know about The Thing. It takes place in the Arctic. The big monster, you never have much talk, is James Arness. He doesn't have much to say. And Christopher Nyby, N-Y-B-Y, a name you may not know, directs the movie. Because he was Howard Hawks's editor, he had edited movies like To Have and Have Not and Red River, and he wanted to be a director. And it looks like Hawks gave him the opportunity. A lot of people say Howard Hawks directed it. Nyby does not agree that he says he did. Some of the actors say they both did, and it's most likely that they both did, that Nyby may have directed it. Hawks was supposed to be there all day. But it is a terrific movie. Arthur loves to talk about the grosses, so it was a high-grossing movie for the time, $1,950,000 just for the U.S. and Canada alone. And it was a movie that scared the living hell out of all of the four boys, three friends and myself, who went to see it.
Is true of really almost anything, and that is it was great. It was a great movie for what it was. This was a great movie, and it stands up to this day if you watch it, black and white. And they did something in The Thing that I always loved, and that was that trailing voices. People were talking, and there was talking in the background Bob Altman used to do that a lot.
Overlapping dialogue.
Overlapping, very effective. And there was a guy in it who was bald and tall, and he was a big newspaper reporter. He was a great actor. I don't even know his name to this day.
Douglas Spencer.
Douglas Spencer. He was absolutely terrific.
Plays Scotty, and yeah. I've seen him in so many movies. The period. Now, interestingly, Julian points out correctly that the exploding of the atomic bomb by the Russians in 1949 was a big event. But 2 years earlier, Kenneth Arnold, who was a private pilot flying over the state of Washington, saw something in the air which he thought looked like flying discs. This is the famous Kenneth Arnold flying saucer incident, where the term flying saucer came about. This is in 1947. This coincides with the Roswell incident, which was not popularized as well. Actually, was popularized because the U.S. Air Force, or excuse me, the U.S. Army Air Force declared that a flying saucer had crashed in New Mexico near the town of Roswell. There's a whole story. We won't get heavily into that. But between flying saucers flying over Washington, atomic bombs exploding, people were freaked out. And I think not only did this inspire The Thing, but 1,000 other science fiction movies for the next 10 years. And we call this the golden age of science fiction movies.
Well, it was a hell of a year, 1951. And I'm sure, Stephen, Arthur, you guys can talk about The Day the Earth Stood Still, the original, the one with Michael Rennie and Patricia Neal, and directed by another former editor, Robert Wise.
Robert Wise. I went to, here's a little story. In 1973, I interviewed a screenwriter named Ted Schurterman. Now, I was writing my book on combat films. I was interviewing a lot of filmmakers and writers who wrote the great World War II movies. Ted wrote a relatively smaller movie, but an interesting movie called Hell to Eternity with Jeffrey Hunter. It was the true story of Guy Gabaldon, an American a California resident who was raised by Japanese Americans and eventually goes to Saipan and captures 1,100 Japanese single-handedly. But during the course of that interview, after we finished, he mentions the fact that it reminded him of something he had done on Them. Now, you got to understand that this is pre-internet. There's no reference books. You can look up all the science fiction movies. I literally jumped out of my seat when he said he had written Them, which, I mean, for me, what The Thing was for you, Julian, when I saw Them, the idea of giant ants running over the New Mexico desert, also chasing James Arness, who did the film 3 years later, just freaked me out. And from then on, anything that took place in the desert, I found kind of freakish. And if you look at a lot of the science fiction films of the 50s, most of them take place in the desert. In fact,
was them with James Whitmore?
Yes.
James Whitmore, James Arness, and Joan Weldon. And
a lot of ants.
And a lot of ants. A lot of ants. So I ended up writing to CineFantastic magazine. I had become a subscriber because I found an original issue at Larry Edmonds bookstore in Hollywood. And CineFantastic was, and later became, the number one periodical for discussing horror, science fiction, and fantasy films. Right, Mike?
It was one of the go-tos for many, many years.
So I started with a retrospective article on Them. I interviewed director Gordon Douglas and writer Ted Schurterman. And then my next article was on Forbidden Planet, another great film of the 1950s, which we'll talk about in a second. But you mentioned The Day the Earth Stood Still. I really, really love that movie. And I spent 6 months gathering every possible bit of information on that movie, and the article became a cover story, my first cover story, featuring a terrific painting by Vincent DeFate, and I got my very first fan mail in my life. I got a letter from Leonard Maltin. Leonard Maltin thanked me for writing this retrospective, which was for me like getting an Academy Award.
That is awesome.
And The Day of the Earth is still also based on a short story. I'm not sure they paid much more than what they paid the gentleman who wrote The Thing, but they changed the title. The original title of The Day of the Earth Stood Still with a short story was Farewell to the Master. and it's not a very good title.
Especially for the South.
No.
Who was a little boy in that movie, Steve?
Billy Gray from later in Father Knows Best. Yeah. I interviewed Billy not only recently on my podcast, but way back then. Michael Rennie, wonderful character actor, was under contract to Fox. You hear his voice a lot because he's always doing voiceover work. He played Klaatu. And as many of the listeners will remember, this is a movie about a spaceship landing in Washington, D.C. on the Mall. I remember it was 3:47 Eastern Standard Time. It was announced by Drew Pearson. And what was very cool about the beginning of this movie is they took a lot of famous newscasters of the day and had them be themselves. I mean, you had H.V. Kaltenborn. What a name.
Yeah.
And Drew Pearson. And just wonderful reality. And I this is interesting because back in 1938, a lot of the listeners remember, and you guys remember, Orson Welles did the famous War of the Worlds broadcast, which apparently a lot of people didn't hear the disclaimer that it was just a fictional thing. They really thought speaking of paranoia, they really thought the Martians had landed in New Jersey. So it was a panicky time, and the way that Robert Wise made the Day of the Earth to still, it seemed like it was really happening, that a spaceship really landed in Washington.
Well, the 50s was such an interesting time to be growing up because the studios were fighting, of course, television, which was beating the living hell out of the motion picture business. And so they fought back with Cast of Thousands, CinemaScope, Tadeo. And one of the things they came back with was 3D. And 1953, they make It Came From Outer Space with Richard Carlson and Barbara Rush, who we just spoke about last time. Barbara right. Rush, who wins the Golden Globe for Best Promising Newcomer in It Came From Outer Space. The interesting thing about this, I think this was a Ray Bradbury tale. The interesting thing about it was that the invaders weren't bad guys. For once, they weren't terrible. They weren't going to take over. They were a little frightening, but they weren't there to take over the town. Interesting movie. Jack Arnold made this movie, and Jack Arnold was kind of a interesting director because he did a lot of science fiction movies. Incredible Shrinking Man, Creature from the Black Lagoon, The Return of the Creature from the Black Lagoon. But he also did The Mouse That Roared. This guy directed The Mouse That Roared. The first time Americans really got to know Peter Sellers, who, like in Dr. Strangelove, but this time way earlier than Dr. Strangelove, he plays three different characters in The Mouse That Roared. So I think Kubrick probably said, hey, this guy could probably play a lot of characters in my movie as well.
Would it be safe to say that the biggest grossing sci-fi movie ever is E.T.? Even though that comes after 1970.
These days, there have been so many huge grossers, the Avengers movies.
I would think Avatar would be number one.
Sci-fi? Yeah,
sure. I don't think anything came close to Avatar, but I may be wrong. But I think you're wonderful.
But in the earlier days of the 40s and 50s, sci-fi movies were always inexpensive little budget things. I got to know a guy named Bob Lippert, who was a producer of things like The Baron of Arizona, and also a movie called, I think, Destination Moon or Destination Mars.
Destination
Moon, Bob Lippert. Yeah. He used to sell dishes to movie theaters in those days and earlier. But that was a good little movie. I think it had Lloyd Bridges. It was okay. That's the thing about those movies. They were all okay. They were good. Donovan's Brain with Brian Donlevy. Small movie, early 50s, mid-50s. Always watchable, you know?
When I started going to the movies, as I've told you a bunch of times, we lived across the street from the old Fox Stadium, which is a Pico just west of Robertson. And on Saturday mornings, we would get a double feature, often science fiction, often horror. And I was a very terrified little only child who could not stand horror films. All my friends would go to the movies. They would sit in the seats. I'd sit in the lobby. I literally sat in the lobby. I couldn't take horror. I had too much imagination. So when the science fiction films would play, however, I kind of could handle them because they had really good stories. They weren't trying to kill people every 2 seconds. And I vividly remember seeing all these movies between, say, 1956 and 59. I must have seen 200 of them. And you remember also Roger Corman started to make his bones in the business by making these cheap little science fiction movies with great titles. Terror from the Year 5000, The Day the World Ended, The Day the World Ended. A lot of post-apocalyptic stuff.
And, what's your favorite sci-fi film of all time, Steve? Your personal favorite?
Well, I think my personal favorite, I would say The Day the Earth Stood Still, the original. We don't talk about the remake. I thought it was, excuse the expression, crap. But the original is such a favorite of mine. And I got to, and them as well, both of those films. In fact, years later, I found Joan Weldon. She was living in New York, who played the female lead in them. And she reminded me that she played the whole desert sequence. It was supposed to be 100 degrees out. And she was wearing a tweed suit. Go figure.
In the day the Earth Stood Still, what did they use for the saucer? What was the, how did they do that?
That's a really good question, Arthur, because you had a very, very good special effects group over at 20th Century Fox. When Klaatu comes out of the spaceship at the beginning of the movie, that's a huge mock-up, probably just 2/3 built because they weren't showing the behind of it. But when the saucer lands in Washington, that's a miniature. And there are all sorts of interesting things about that movie. One of the key questions I got answered from Edmund North, who wrote the screenplay, later when it shared an Oscar with Coppola on Patton. There's a scene that the many people who've seen this movie says where Klaatu, the Michael Rennie character, is afraid that he's going to get killed. So he turns to Patricia Neal and says, if something should happen to me, you've got to go to Gort. Now, Gort is the giant steel robot that I found terrifying. It says, you must say these three words, Klaatu, Barada, Nikto. Now, no one's ever explained what this, but when I got to interview Edmund North, I asked him, what does Klaatu, Barada, Nikto is? And he said it means if there's hope for Earth, if the scientists can be reached.
Hey.
In what language? His own?
In Klaatu speak.
I thought it sounded like a space rash, a fungus from space. That's
so. So that's one of the great trivia questions. But North was very nice. And by the way, this is interesting. When Klaatu gets, you know, he ends up being captured by the army. He escapes from the hospital and he steals a clothing, and the dry cleaning tag on it says Major Carpenter. And then there's this whole thing where people over the years have felt that Klaatu is Christ, that there's a big Christ parable or metaphor here, because his name is Carpenter. He's resurrected, as we know from the movie. And North admitted it was a very low-key background ID he came up with.
You mentioned Roger Corman and a roadshow Roger Corman, which you would have thought that's as low as you're going to get on budget movies, was a fellow I got to know named Jack H. Harris. Jack H. Harris was originally a theater manager, and then he became a distributor in Philadelphia, Arthur, home of Mark Shapiro. And he was watching television, and he saw on Playhouse 90 this very good-looking actor who he thought had talent. And within a few days, he was in New York, because he was an L.A. guy. He went to the theater, and he saw A Hat Full of Rain, and that same kid was there, and that was Steve McQueen. And he decided then that he was going to have Steve McQueen do this movie that eventually became called The Blob. That was not their original title. We should say that The Blob was like a giant piece of jello that oozed into town and, you know, kind of consumed people and got bigger and bigger.
I love that movie theater scene. It's such an awesome movie.
When they come running out of the theater, yeah.
The original title was The Glob,
that's
with,
right.
A G.
And they,
with a G.
And they found out they were afraid that Walt Kelly, who had, I think Pogo was cartoonist, he would sue them. Now, the interesting thing is, I think all four of us know, you cannot copyright a title. Now, you can't call your movie Gone with the Wind. You can't call your movie The Godfather. But by and large, copyright, you cannot copyright a title that's not a gigantic a film. So they did. They went from Glob to Blob. That's true. But here's the interesting thing. He sells it to Paramount. Jack Harris does, The Blob. And the guys at Paramount say, we need a better opening song. You don't have anything here with a song. And they get a guy to write it, the music, named Burt Bacharach. And and it called Beware the Blob, or Beware of the Blob. The
lyrics. It leaps, it slides, it glides across the floor, right through the door and all around the walls. A splotch, a blotch, beware of the blob.
And pretty the lyrics awesome. Are not written by Hal David, by his brother, Mac David. Mac David wrote the lyrics to the Beware the Blob. And Arthur, you'll be thrilled to know that's your favorite movie or one of them. It's A Mad, Mad, Mad World. Mac David wrote the music, the lyrics to that. It's a mad, 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 mad world. Yeah. So there you go.
A little bit of trivia with The Blob, though, is that if you notice in the movie, originally the blob is clear and it just gets... It gets redder and redder as the movie goes along. It's the people's blood in everything until it's like.
I always have heard, you know, the Roger Corman school of acting was just people going,
That's true.
People can't hear that, but it was making a crazy face, being terrified.
Yeah. The Blob was a huge hit for Paramount. The other thing I should have pointed out, whereas a lot of the cheap science fiction movies of the 50s were shot in black and white, this was done in color. And I think that as Mike says, that blood color for the blob helped the helped the color resolution. The other person I think, yes, I read this, that if you listen carefully, the scene in the movie theater where the blob eventually invades the theater, there's a very weird soundtrack going on where somebody's trying to freak you out with the voice of some demon because they're playing it in a movie theater. And I'm forgetting his name now. The Johnny Carson's number two banana.
Ed McMahon.
That's Ed McMahon's voice.
Yep.
The doom thing from that movie. That movie really holds up nicely today. You know, it's funny. Every science fiction movie in those days seemed to have teenagers who were in love getting caught up in something. And, of course, they have the requisite Lover's Lane sequence. By the way, as a young teenager, I was trying to always find Lover's Lanes. We didn't really have them in Los Angeles, but apparently back east, Lover's Lanes were very popular. Julian, did you know of a Lover's Lane in your area?
If you think the Lover's Lane was in the Bronx, you've got the wrong guy. No, there wasn't. But I can say this about this guy, Jack Harris, that Arthur would certainly appreciate, and well, everybody would, but he had a couple of things that I loved. He said, the only thing positive is the negative. And he owned all his negatives. All these movies we'll talk about later, Equinox and 4D Man and, oh my God, Schlock. You know, the movie Schlock, which we can talk about a little later too. But
most of those little black and white sci-fi movies of the 1950s, maybe the late 40s, were profitable. They were made for nothing.
Nothing.
In every case. 40,000,
50,000 sometimes.
Yeah, and at worst, they could be second features and drive-ins, and you know, there was always a way to make money with them.
Oh, you had movies like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, or, you know, silly, silly type movies, but they were so good. So good.
They were commercial. They were commercial.
Yeah. And they would release
the man, the guy who grew to be 100 feet tall. I forget is Glenn something, his name.
Glenn Strange. It's
Glenn
called
Strange.
The Amazing Colossal Man. It was released on a double feature with Attack of the Puppet People.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned that thing with the young people. Steve Spielberg did that with your Jaws. He had the young teenagers, you know, on the beach and all that stuff. And that's how that all started.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You always pay a lot of attention to those movies.
Well, I'm not sure if it was a Corman. It may have been American International. But there was a movie called, oh my God.
Corman made a lot of movies for American International.
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. There were a lot of them. Mike, help me out here. It's the little aliens with the long nails that when they strike you, they give you alcohol and make you drunk. Remember that?
Oh God, I do remember that.
Oh, it's called Invasion of the Saucer Men.
That's right.
And that starts out once again in one of those Lover Lane situations. There's these small towns in the rural areas always had Lover's Lanes.
So you also had movies like Santa Claus versus the Martians, you know.
And also we have to remember that these pictures were big in drive-ins. Oh, and in drive-ins, that's where Lover's Lanes were. In fact,
you're absolutely right. You know. That was the urban equivalent of the Lover's Lane, exactly.
Yeah.
Now, occasionally, the studios would put up some real money. And in 1956, MGM releases Forbidden Planet.
Yes.
Forbidden Planet could arguably be the first real epic full color science fiction movie, although you can go back to the 1930s and you can talk about some of the H.G. Wells films. I think Things to Come was fairly epic at that time because it was big and was shot in black and white, of course. But Forbidden Planet, and I'll mention War of the Worlds as well, because when you mention color and studio, you got to mention War of the Worlds at Paramount. But Forbidden Planet was based on, of all things, a Shakespeare play called The Tempest.
Oh, very much so.
And it was adopted by Cyril Hume, and Walter Pidgeon played the lead character, well, the co-lead, because Leslie Nielsen, who would go on to do all those comedies like Airplane, played a very straight-laced Captain J.J. Adams of the space cruiser C-51D.
If I can just say that, for a 14-year-old, all we cared about was Anne Francis.
Yes.
Loved Anne Francis, guys.
Oh, my golly, Anne Francis knocked us on our ass.
It's interesting because Forbidden Planet was such a precursor and such laid so much groundwork for what came later. Star Trek was based off of Forbidden Planet. You could see the beginnings of Star Trek in the movie. And it's just amazing to see that. And it introduced a very famous robot in that movie, too.
Robbie
the robot. And I've got to tell you a funny story, because one of my retrospective articles, I was told that if you're going to do a retrospective on Forbidden Planet, you've got to contact Bill Malone. Now, Bill Malone was a young filmmaker in Studio City, and I went over to his house that day, and I knocked on the door. He invited me in, and I walked into his den, and guess who's in the den?
Robbie.
The original Robbie the Robot.
Oh, that's awesome. That is awesome.
Worth the trip.
Yeah.
That was worth the trip. Bill and I became very close friends. I worked as a publicist on some of his early movies. He later sold Robbie for, drum roll please, $4.5 million.
Whoa.
And he found Robbie at a closing museum in Buena Park. I'm not sure he paid more than $10,000 for him. So probably in the history of movie props, it was the biggest sale of all time. Marvin Miller, the wonderful voice of Marvin Miller, was Robbie.
The millionaire.
The millionaire, exactly. Morbius. Anyway, there were little people who operated, not little people, smaller people. They weren't little people, but very small people were inside Robbie operating all the gadgets. But Robbie was the star of that movie as far as I was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Steve, who was the usher or the guy worked at the Chinese Grauman Theater? who was in, was one of the played a monster in one of the movies. He was seven.
No, you're talking about 7 foot 7 inch Locke Martin. Locke Martin was the guy who wore the Gort suit in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Right.
Oh yeah, and he, you know, when he comes out, you know, there were different versions of him. There was actually a 9 foot fiberglass statue that stands outside the ship, which they immobilize. They think they immobilize in plastic, but they don't. But he also wore the suit. And apparently Locke Martin was not a very strong person, because at one point in the movie, as you recall, he has to carry Patricia Neal into the ship. And they had to, I think he's carrying a dummy, because he suffered from, I guess, gigantism or something that weakens the bones, so he could not carry Patricia Neal.
And the one thing about Patricia Neal...
Yeah, why is Patricia Neal really a very sexy woman? Can we explain it, guys?
I can.
Why is Patricia Neal sexy?
I mean, of course, we have to decide about her parents. I guess that would help. They created her, but
she had tremendous sex appeal.
I would say in HUD, she is as sexy as any woman I've ever seen on a screen in that movie. But that's not science fiction. That is reality.
So what?
No,
sex, you know?
Absolutely.
How about sexy science fiction, guys?
You're absolutely that's another right.
Well, you mentioned Anne Francis in Forbidden Planet, but you know, the thing is, sex and sci-fi went really well together. You had Zsa Zsa Gabor leading
the queen of
outer space. That was the thing about the movies in that time. In fact, there were a lot of stories that were kind of the same story. A group of male space travelers go to another planet that is just populated by these beautiful, voluptuous women in high heels.
Right.
I wouldn't complain, you know.
No,
I think Abbott and Costello did one called Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. And then another great little film that Fox released was called... let's see. It's called, I'm cut to the quick here. It's Rod Taylor.
All About Eve?
Not all. Yeah. All About Eve. No, it's a great movie where a spaceship of guys goes through the time barrier and they end up on Earth, like almost like a Planet of the Apes type story where it's now the future and the planet has been, all the people have been killed. And I'm forgetting the title now, but the concept of going to these planets and there's these gorgeous women was something that Hollywood really, really jumped all over.
How about Barbarella, Jane Fonda?
Jane Fonda, sure.
And Laurie Nelson in The Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Of course.
No, not Laurie Nelson. That wasn't Ozzie, Laurie Nelson.
Ozzie Nelson?
Harriet.
Julie Adams.
Where was Laurie? Laurie was.
She may have been in one of the sequels.
Because she was in a couple of those films. I remember.
It's interesting though, because that era, it had a lot of kitsch. It had a lot, you know, and you know, one of the biggest kitschy movies of that time, of course, Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Oh, Ed Wood.
Ed Wood. You know,
some of the worst special effects ever involved, including, right. I think, a plate for the flying saucer. Why not?
Exactly. Did you all like the movie Ed Wood? I did.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just amazing. You know, you even had, you know, Dracula in the movie.
Yeah, by the way, the title of the movie I was thinking of with Rod Taylor is called World Without End.
Ah.
That's definitely worth the bad guys in that movie are these woolly looking alien. They're kind of mutation creatures that look like they came out of the jungle, kind of half ape, half man. And Rod Taylor helps design a bazooka because the people who are the futuristic people who live underground, they don't have any weapons, so they have to kind of develop some weaponry.
Was there a movie called Amazon Woman?
There was Amazon Woman on the Moon, but that was
Amazon on the Moon. Something on the moon.
That was much later.
which was a spin on the Glenn Strange movie.
I always liked the title Catwoman on the Moon.
True. But it's interesting also, guys, because you've been mentioning a lot of 1950s movies. Sci-fi in the film era goes way back to the turn of the century. And, you know, into the silent era. And we touched on quite a few of those last week when we did the silent films.
Yeah, Trip to the Moon is one of the earliest.
Melies.
Yeah, exactly. Trip to the Moon, but Metropolis is, and you also had, you know, takes, other science fiction takes, and you had, you know, it's just interesting, and you had a lot to be based off of going into the 1930s and 1940s, but you know, Steve touched on H.G. Wells, and you had War of the Worlds was, you know, in the early 50s, in 1950.
Which was originally conceived of as a potential film for Cecil B. DeMille.
Yep.
And it was developed at Paramount all the way back in the 30s, but they never could quite crack it. It's interesting, a lot of us who were reading classics comics back in the 60s or late 50s, there was a classics comics edition of War of the Worlds, where you see those Martian war machines on three legs, which is kind of what Spielberg did in the remake a few years ago, where they're like tripods.
Because that's what they were based off in the book.
Exactly. But when George Pal decided to do the 1953 War in War of the Worlds, he hired a production designer named Al Nozaki. And Al Nozaki gave them kind of a teardrop look, and they were suspended on electromagnetic forces. So they kind of float in the air. And I'll tell you, the 53 War of the Worlds is pretty darn scary and very well made.
Oh, I loved how they had like the teardrop, like you said, the teardrop spaceships with the eye sticking out of it. And
right.
Which was just, and the noise that they made.
How do they end the War of the Worlds? Specifically, the Tom Cruise War of the Worlds, even though it's later on. How did that movie end, guys?
Well, the same thing happened that happened in 53. It's actually a quote from, I think it's a quote from H.G. Wells. It was the littlest things that God had put on Earth that destroyed the Martians. They became, they got very bad colds that killed them.
They were susceptible to viruses. And it was in both versions. And that, because it was also in the book. That, you know, they couldn't handle, they were anemic. And in the books and also in the Spielberg version, the characters were basically harvesting the humans for the blood because they were, the Martians were anemic and they were trying to build their, you know, immune systems up. Mm-hmm. They were overtaken by our viruses and that's what killed them. Humans couldn't take care of it, even with our technology. The scene where they drop the atomic bomb on them in the 1953, and you see them come out of the blast with the shields up over them, like the domes, that was just so awesome.
Oh, so awesome and so frightening. And of course, they're attacking Los Angeles. And of course, I saw the movie in L.A., and I felt like my own city was under attack.
Another, what did Wells call his radio show that changed the world?
War of the Worlds, yeah.
It was War of the Worlds. Yeah. War of the Worlds.
Are you thinking, Orson Welles?
Mercury.
That was the Mercury Theater.
Right. That's right.
That show was War of the Worlds.
Yeah, because he did that back in 1937, I think.
38.
Halloween.
Yeah.
Halloween,
I mentioned this fellow Jack H. Harris before, and he, Roger Corman, and Sam Arkoff, who ran AIP, always had this kind of concept. Let's get a good title and let's get some great artwork and we will raise the money for these kind of movies. And I spent 25 years at the Cannes Film Festival. And when I used to go initially, I was probably the only American there. It was really a European festival at the beginning when I went in the 60s. But those guys would come with their artwork. They'd have an idea and a title and this artwork, and they would raise money from all over the world. It was quite interesting to me.
It's hard to really understand that movies could be made in those days for what we call the coffee budget on contemporary movies. I mean, you know, you could make, I mean, Roger Corman talks about some of these movies where they shot it in 2 weeks. In 62, Ray Milland was hired to do Panic in Year Zero, which is one of the first post-apocalyptic titles. And, you know, it's about a typical American family that's going off in the California mountains on a vacation. They stop to close the windows because they think it's going to rain because there was what they thought was a thunder. They look behind them and there's a mushroom cloud over Los Angeles. And that's where it takes off from. And that movie, I think, was shot in 2.5 weeks.
No wonder you sat in the lobby most of the time.
Poor Los Angeles.
Now, I will tell you guys that Milton Berle's attorney was a wonderful little man named Paul Schreibman. Paul Schreibman he was referred to as a Jewish elf. He was very short, but very smart, very smart. And this is a man who, after World War II, represented Toho. And he put together the Godzilla deal. Godzilla was the biggest picture in the world in the last 2 weeks. It lives forever.
Mm-hmm. The original, but that too,
the Godzilla was a science fiction movie.
Oh, 1956. Yep. 56. And they were hesitant to bring it to the U.S. market with no Americans. So they added that whole Raymond Burr wraparound where he's looking out the window. Looking at something, and that's...
I was surprised with all those Godzilla movies that they never had a film called Godzilla versus Perry Mason.
Perry Mason coming after him for all the damage he's done to
him. That's right, suing him. Suing him for big money. I would say...
I always love Milton's line, they were roasting Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he said to Arnold Schwarzenegger at the Beverly Hilton Hotel, "Arnold, you are to acting what Raymond Burr was to pole vaulting."
Boy.
Now, we mentioned George Pal earlier as the producer of War of the Worlds, which, by the way, was directed by Byron Haskin. 1960, as the new decade dawns, Pal produces and directs The Time Machine, which to
me is a wonderful film.
Rod Taylor... if you know, some of these movies don't hold up very well, but The Time Machine plays like it played in 1960. It's a wonderful movie and wonderfully imaginative, and it has kind of even a whimsical quality. The Time Machine is wonderful. As you recall, he climbs into his time machine. He looks out the window, and he's across the street from a very small department store with a mannequin. And as he goes through time, they're changing her clothes rapidly, rapidly, rapidly. And the smile on her face never changes, just like George, the character Rod Taylor plays. And then that movie introduced Yvette Mimieux as Weena. Weena, who belongs to a member, she's a member of the Eloi. And as you recall, the Eloi are the little blonde kids, the teenagers, who live so effortlessly until you find out that the Morlocks are killing them off for cannibalism. Mm-hmm.
But there again, you have the sex appeal in sci-fi, which it was easy to do. Mm-hmm. And Miss Yvette Mimieux was the sexy version of Sandra Dee.
Oh,
several years after, yeah.
It's interesting. In that movie, it was so beautifully shot and everything. And the machine itself, I actually got to see the machine in person. It's the details, the wheels spinning behind him and everything. And it's just gorgeous.
I heard the name Walter Pigeon before, and having nothing to do with nothing as far as the sci-fi. Has anybody here seen Walter Pigeon in anything, anytime that he wasn't absolutely great?
He was always Walter Pigeon.
Always Walter Pigeon.
He was great, though. But he was always—I agree with you—he was always good. In the 1960s, there was a movie made that I think I'll even stump Steve on, perhaps, called The Vulture. The Vulture starred Broderick Crawford and Akim Temerov. Takes place in London, and it's about a vulture that's terrorizing London. And the conceit of this is that they don't show you the vulture. You don't see him for most of the movie. But then on a Terrace lands the vulture, except this was low budget. So the vulture, all you see are his legs, which are two plumber things that you plunge.
A plunger.
Two plungers. That's awesome. And but was so great, they pasted feathers on it. So these plungers. So I, of course, I was trying to put together at that point a horror film sci-fi package, and I found out that the vulture was available, and on top of it had been a Paramount movie. So I think between the Blob and the vulture, Paramount was really kind of getting down there. But that was my real experience with a sci-fi movie of sort.
You know, I started to be able to watch some of the horror films, and there was another guy like your Jack H. Harris, Julian, William Castle.
Oh, yes.
And William Castle, yeah. Known primarily for horror. Of course, horror and science fiction are very, very close to each other. But I remember he came up with a thing for those of us fraidy cats who didn't want to look at the ghosts. To look at the ghosts, you had a little 3D type viewer. It wasn't really a 3D, but if you wanted to see the ghosts in the movie 13 Ghosts, you would put the glasses on. Yeah. And he was always coming up with little gimmicks like that. And of course, The House on Haunted Hill, which was, I think, 1958, they actually did some stunts where they had a skeleton hung from the ceiling and it went down a wire during the filmmaking. Can you imagine how scary that would have been?
Yes. Well, I think his one big claim to fame was Rosemary's Baby, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, that was a big one for him. Absolutely.
That was a very scary movie.
Yes, it was.
And he did something called The Tingler. And The Tingler was also horror-y, science fiction-y. Another movie that I thought was very scary for me was The Fly, 1958.
Vincent Price.
Vincent Price, David Hedison, although in those days he was called Al Hedison. And that had presented the most interesting idea of matter transportation, where you could transport matter from one side of the planet to another, kind of like what the Star Trek series did with their transporter room, where they were transporting humans. So the main character decides he's going to test it on himself, but what he doesn't realize is a fly has landed inside the transporter room with him. So what happens is he gets transported, but now he's half fly. And I'll tell you, when he comes out of that room with a fly head, I jump 3 feet.
and we know it was remade later with Jeff Goldblum.
Yes.
Jeff Goldblum. So, and then, of course, remember the little boy, Charles Herbert, a wonderful young actor, finds the fly with the human head. He was saying, "Help me, help me." When I heard that, I was out the door.
Again, I'm surprised you were in the theater. You know, I mentioned Jack Harris, and after The Blob, he followed it up with something called the 4D man, four dimension man. And this particular man in the movie was able to walk through walls and do all kinds of things. And they were trying to find a way to sell this movie. Universal had it. He sold it to Universal. And they came, he went to Lloyd's of London. He got $1 million from them as a backing, not to do, and all they had to do was say that they would back him if this ever happened. And they advertised, the producer guarantees anyone who can duplicate the feats of the 4D man will get $1 million. Not too many. A lot of people banged into the wall, but they didn't get through it.
Now,
gentlemen, what is the name? What is the name of the movie that the original had Kevin McCarthy, I believe?
The Invasions of the Body Snatchers.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers, remade with Jeff Goldblum.
Right.
Years later. That was a scary movie.
Oh, very much so. That was all about, you know, communism and, you know, and such. So it's interesting how politics also got into the sci-fi movies and, you know, created the scares and everything like that. It's interesting, though, because as you got from the 50s, you also had Disney getting involved with, like, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and, you know, stories like that. But they also had stories that going into the 1960s. You had movies like Fantastic Voyage, where they went into the people's bodies.
Yes,
they shrunk the people down.
And when that movie came out, I thought that was so inventive. It was just stunningly inventive, and Fox did that. Their art department was known for being very inventive. They did the movie version of Jules Verne's Journey to the Center of the Earth in 59 with James Mason, Pat Boone, and Arlene Dahl, which they go into the earth. And those sets with the giant mushrooms were just amazing. Now, you know, we're getting into the 60s. And for my money, you know, I mentioned earlier that the studios would invest in money in films like Forbidden Planet and War of the Worlds. But when it came time to Planet of the Apes in 68, that was something that just blew our minds. And there's much been written about the Planet of the Apes movies being kind of a metaphor for racism. But what do you remember about the first Planet of the Apes, Arthur? Do you remember seeing it?
Yes, I do. It was a huge hit. I remember that very well. 20th Century Fox.
Arthur Jacobs was the brain behind that, who bought the Pierre Boulle novel. Pierre Boulle had been known for having written the novel Bridge on the River Kwai. And I actually got in touch with him when I was researching my combat films book. And Planet of the Apes is just a very, very good story. To modern audiences, it had the impact perhaps that Gulliver's Travels had on prior centuries. It's very popular.
What was the movie in the 1960s where they go through a guy's body in a submarine?
That's what we were talking about. Fantastic Voyage.
Yes.
And what? So it's amazing the stuff they came out with and the inventiveness of it.
Did Rick Baker do the makeup for Planet of the Apes?
I think he worked under the guy who did, I think John Chambers. I think he was an apprentice to John Chambers. I believe that was the guy. But that first sequence, or that early sequence, where Charlton Heston and his two astronaut buddies are running from what they hear, a lot of noise, but they don't see anything. Then all of a sudden you see the apes on horseback. What an image to show an audience in 68. It was just mind-blowing.
And the makeup on it was just stunning compared to... Well,
stunning
before,
and that's Franklin Schaffner as the director, right?
Frank Schaffner, exactly. Yeah. Who had a specialty of doing things with peas. He did Planet of the Apes, he did Patton, and he did Papillon.
You know, Fox had been so cold in the early 60s. The whole episode with Cleopatra, but come to the late 60s, and they had a string of movies: Planet of the Apes, Butch Cassidy's Sundance Kid, and Patton, and maybe something else, but just those three, they were super successful at that point. Anyway.
I think they also had Valley of the Dolls, which I think was a big box office hit too.
I think so, yes. But it's interesting because as Arthur had mentioned earlier, you also had in the late 60s, you also had Barbarella. You had mentioned that earlier.
Paramount, yes.
Yes, and that was huge. That was Jane Fonda.
I think besides The Thing, I know we just mentioned it recently, but Invasion of the Body Snatchers was a very frightening concept. It just was, where you could be taken over, and these odds were growing at all times, it seemed.
You benefited from a marvelous cast. I mean, Kevin McCarthy is perfect as the Dr. Bunnell, and you had
Dana Winter.
Was it Dana or Donna?
I think it's Dana, D-A-N-A.
Yeah. Dana Winter is marvelous as his girlfriend, and then a marvelous, some great character actors. A young Carolyn Jones plays the wife of the guy who's his friend, the Belichicks. Yeah, no, it's great. I actually worked on the remake. I was hired by Phil Kaufman and Bob Solo to take the original materials for promotion to all the science fiction conventions. That was the 1978. I went to 15 science fiction conventions. My first trips to New York were to science fiction conventions. And we had these big kind of fluorescent bumper stickers about Invasion of the Body Snatchers, which the kids would grab and put on the elevators, and we have to we had gotten into a lot of trouble.
Steve,
you were the king of the sequels.
I'm interested at those conventions. Are they selling things? What's going on in a sci-fi convention?
Oh, there's so much going on.
There's so much going on. I mean,
that's a podcast episode on itself.
Exactly. The core room in a science fiction convention is called the dealer's room, where you have dozens of dealers hawking comic books and memorabilia, posters, still photographs. And then you have another room where they have celebrity panels where they bring the cast out. It's gotten so big. I mean, you go down to Comic-Con in San Diego, 200,000 or 300,000 people. I went to one of the first Comic-Cons in San Diego. There were 500 people there. It's become big business. And we were one of the first studio. It all started with Star Wars. George Lucas hired a guy named Charlie Lippincott to go to the science fiction conventions with a preparation, you know, a presentation on what Star Wars is all about. And that's how I got my job. Phil Kaufman and George Lucas were very friendly. And George recommended that Phil hire a guy to go to the conventions to promote Invasion of the Body Snatchers. So that's how I got my gig.
Yeah, now these big conventions, like 150,000 is a average size one for San Diego. It's just, and it's over days, not just a daily thing. And
you know, the studios will bring down the stars of the new Avengers movie and they'll get 5,000 people in their main auditorium. I mean, and you walk on the floor of the main room where they're not only selling comics now, but each of the studios has a presentation for their latest film slate. It's like, it's like, you can't move. It's like the epicenter of American pop culture.
It is.
There was a time when the fortunes of P&A, of publicity advertising, were spent on double truck ads in the New York Times, LA Times, newspapers all over America. And that expenditure is gone. But what's going on is social media, of course, and these kind of things like conventions.
Yes.
Much more effective than any kind of any other stuff.
And we'll talk about this more in part two of this story. But I think that science fiction, fantasy and horror films, which were once a segment of the release schedule for typical studios, are now dominating the studio release schedules.
Oh, very much so.
And hundreds
of millions. We would be remiss, though, if we don't touch on this last movie that I wanted to touch on. Let's talk about 2001, A Space Odyssey. Because
that was a game changer
in so many
ways. Doug Trumbull's special effects, as you pointed out before, Mike, were just off the charts. I think the cliche is that if you wanted to go into the movie theaters and be stoned, that was the movie to do it with. To this day, I find the movie a bit baffling, but very entertaining and certainly changed the course of science fiction, which we'll discuss in our part two. We'll probably spend more time talking about 2001 and why it changed science fiction in part two of our show.
I hope at that time someone will explain the movie to me.
Yeah. We'll have to have diagrams. We'll have to have all these different things.
They did have one of the greatest posters. The poster look on that movie was unbelievable.
I'm sorry, I can't do that, Dave.
Oh, the haunting voice of Hal is just like,
Hal. Well, we've come to the end of one of my favorite shows, guys. We really just were dancing on my floor, baby. I love science fiction, and thank you, Julian and Mike, for your insights, and Arthur, thank you for your insights into distribution as always, and exhibition. If you've made it this far in our show, why don't you subscribe? It's free. We're available on all the podcasts, Apple, Amazon, Spotify, and we have our own YouTube channel as well. And as I say each week, please write to us. Tell us what you think of our show, or tell us what you think we should cover, or what kind of guests we should get. And we will go into the marketplace and try to find those guests. You can reach out to us at talesfromhollywoodland@gmail.com.
And soon we do the Beatles.
And we will boldly go where no podcast has gone before.
A yellow submarine.
I want to hold your hand.
Bye, everybody. Have a good week. We'll be right back.
new on the 42 cast? Let's ask my co-hosts.
We're talking about Doctor Who,
comic book shows and movies,
and we're talking about all things Star Trek,
and so much more.
Check us out on Google Play, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes.
It's only on the 42 cast, your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything.
So, Nathan, when are we finally talking Babylon 5?
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.